What can we believe about and how can we believe in Jesus in the 21st century? Certainly in light of the atrocities of the 20th and the drift from the religion that followed. In best-selling and acclaimed author James Carroll's new book, Christ Actually the Son of God for the Secular Age, Carroll asserts that traditional faith in Jesus, even including his somehow being Son of God, can be found again by reaching both into the past, reinstating Jesus as a Jew, and into the future, recognizes Jesus as a surpassing figure of human possibility. Again, the name of the book is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age. The book is published by Viking. James Carroll, welcome to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
My privilege, Joe. Glad to be with you.
Very nice to have you with us. What led you to this path of wanting to explore this particular story?
I was born in 1943. The year that the word genocide was coined. I've been obsessed, even as a Christian, since my youth with the Holocaust. And reckoning with the Holocaust has defined my work as a writer. And finally, this direct look at the way in which Christians think of Jesus and the movement of contempt for the Jewish people that culminated in the Holocaust, how they're related. One of my convictions is that the Holocaust was a historic turning point, not just for the Jewish people or for Germany, but for the West, for the human project generally, because after the Holocaust, religion could never be understood the way it was understood before. And it's part of why Europe, for one place, walked away from religion in the years after the World War II. And it's why Christianity itself, certainly including my own Roman Catholicism, has been embarked on a profound act of reform, of repentance, of change. My book about Jesus looks at a very direct way at the way in which, by misremembering Jesus, we set in motion the dark momentum that led to the crime against the Jewish people. Bottom line, we forgot that Jesus himself was Jewish, so we could imagine that he was the enemy of that people, and the consequences followed.
The book, obviously, you look at religious violence. You became a Catholic priest. You turned against war. You joined the anti-war movement. And give us a sense of how that formed your ideas of religion and violence, and how those became intertwined.
I grew up thinking religion and war were opposites. It came as a big shock to me to discover that religion was a source of war, a justification for war. In my own tradition, I'm a Catholic, and in my own experience, Vietnam was decisive, and it came as a big shock to me to discover that Catholicism was an element in what caused the Vietnam War. The post-colonial, tyrannical Ngo Dinh Diem regime in Vietnam, in Saigon as it was called, was Catholic and trying to impose a Catholic power structure on a Buddhist population. It absolutely knocked my socks off when I realized that my Catholicism was part of this really misbegotten war. And that led me to a whole new reckoning with the way in which God had been used to justify violence down through the centuries, the Crusades, the religious wars of the Reformation, but going all the way back to the founding days of the Christian movement, when in the Gospels themselves, the story is told to justify contempt for Jews and Jewish religion, as if Jesus was not himself Jewish. And I find in that story right there the beginning of this horrible dynamic that led to the defining of one people positively by defining another people negatively, which has led to the horror of religiously justified conflict ever since. So by changing the way we think of Jesus, we actually begin to dismantle what has been one of the basic structures of violent conflict down through the centuries.
We just had Karen Armstrong on our program, and she makes the case that that religion should be taken away from that, because it's usually more politics than it is religion causing that violence.
Well, she makes an important point there, and I'm sure I don't disagree with her. I've learned so much from her over the years. But I would make a different point, and that is to say that politics often draws on the power of religion, and that's my concern. It's when politics uses religion as a kind of burning engine, you might say. You see that in a very destructive way in the Middle East today. The violence of jihadist Islam is not religious, but it's certainly true that they use religion as a powerful force to spark and sustain the contempt and hatred that they have for their enemies. Christians have done the same thing. In the United States of America, we've used religion to justify our sense of ourselves as a nation set above other nations. We think of ourselves as specially chosen by God. And that religious idea has had actually quite negative consequences down through the years, when America has set itself up triumphalistically over other peoples. So my concern is to defuse and disarm religion as a source of political mischief. The distinction is worth drawing, but my focus is on purging religion of any impulse it has to justify political violence.
You do focus on the book and look at the 1960s, and specifically the Second Vatican Council. This was a major influence on you and your life. We're hearing more about it, of course, now with our new Pope. Give us a sense of why it mattered so much, and ultimately how you came back to it when writing this story of Christ actually.
Well, the Second Vatican Council, recall, was a meeting of all the world's Catholic bishops. It took place in Rome in several sessions between the years 1962 and 1965. Not incidentally, exactly the years of the Vietnam War beginning and the climax of the nuclear standoff between the USSR and the U.S. with the Cuban Missile Crisis, which unfolded the very week that the Council began. So the Council Fathers responded both to the Holocaust, the failure of Christianity made quite clear, and to the threat of nuclear annihilation. And it's those two brackets, Auschwitz on one side, Hiroshima on the other, that forced these leaders of the Catholic Church to reckon with the basic need for change in what we believe and in what we uphold as a religion. And so the Second Vatican Council, for example, began uprooting religious anti-Judaism by renouncing the slander that the Jews are Christ killers. The Second Vatican Council said no to that. The Second Vatican Council said no, in effect, to the just war theory in the nuclear age, and called into question whether war can be an instrument of justice at all once the possible destruction of human civilization is at risk. So the Second Vatican Council was a defining turning point, not just for the Catholic Church or even for Christianity, but I would say for the West. It was a profound reckoning with what had been laid bare at the Holocaust, which went to the heart of Christendom, of the culture that came of Christendom. And it was the beginning of a process, not the end of it. So Pope Francis, quite emphatically puts himself in the line of what began at Vatican II and promises to continue it. His emphasis on the plight of the poor is a hugely important reckoning with what now may threaten the global future more than anything, which is the global gulf between a small minority of affluent people and a vast population of impoverished people. The Pope has insisted on this as critical, and of course he's right.
We had a wonderful conversation when your book, Practicing Catholic, came out, and and I'm interested in that book, was several years ago before this Pope. And I'm interested if how your feelings have changed. I know we were talking a lot in that conversation of some of the things that needed to be done and some of the concerns of the direction that the church was headed. Are you more optimistic?
Joe, it's been breathtaking for me to see the power of change that has come with this new Pope. And it's the thing that's most striking to me about it is not just the impact he's had on the Catholic Church, but the impact he's had on the world at large. It seems very clear to me that human beings broadly understand that there's real trouble in our condition today. And we're all looking for reasons to be hopeful, looking for ways to maybe address the unseen world, the world of the transcendent, looking for language that used to come pretty easily to us in religion, but doesn't so much anymore. So Pope Francis is speaking to the longing of people everywhere. It's very powerful, and it's very hopeful. We have some very severe problems right in front of us. Climate change is, in a way, the most obvious. If we don't change the way we're living on this planet, our great-grandchildren will perhaps not live into the future. I mean, it's that grave. Can we change it? Can we do it? Is it possible? Is it too late? Can we get out from under the scourge of nuclear weapons? Can we do it? Can we bridge the gulf between the rich and the poor that is so threatening? Can we do it? What we see in Pope Francis is a simple affirmation that we can do it. Change at this level is possible. Pope Francis is calling for it. And he presides over the most conservative institution on the planet, the Roman Catholic Church. If that can change, what can't? And the truth is, we see it changing right in front of us, quite dramatically, day by day. In Practicing Catholic, I wrote a book about the church, focused there. In this new book, Christ Actually, I'm focused on the figure of Jesus. And there's the reason for hope, as Pope Francis keeps insisting, that it's the figure of Jesus who gives us this hope, what he represented, what he lifted up, the power of compassionate love and of mercy to overcome huge obstacles that stand in the way of justice and authentic community. The truth is, I'm more hopeful as I come into my old age than I've ever been. And that is a huge but very welcome surprise.
And I agree with you. And I, what I find fascinating, though, and we've seen this just in recent weeks with the Pope coming up against concern amongst the bishops and cardinals in the church over definitions of marriage. And you see that conservatism flare and contradict what the Pope is saying, which I believe to be very much what you're talking about in the book, as to what Christ has taught us and the meaning of Christ. And yet it seems when it comes to these issues of marriage and who is included and who is not included, that conservatism takes us away from the teachings of Christ.
Well, if the conservatives weren't pushing back and weren't vociferous in doing so, then the change wouldn't be that significant. So the pushback is a signal of how important, how deep the change goes. The simplest example that comes to mind is the change in the Pope's attitude toward gay people, inviting the Catholic Church to get over its homophobia and to begin to treat gay people as fully respected, fully equal members of the community, of the human community, for goodness sake. And there's a kind of basic decency rooted in the Pope's understanding of who Jesus Christ was that drives him. Now, it's very clear that the forces against which he's pushing are very, very powerful, And it may not be possible to change at this level. We'll see. But stepping back from the particularly religious issue, the forces confronting the human species today are extremely powerful. The poison of the atmosphere by fossil fuels is an extremely powerful obstacle to humane rescue of the environment. Can we do it? The proliferation of nuclear weapons, the arming of extreme groups with weapons of mass destruction, can we stop it? These are huge, huge questions. The trick is to maintain and nurture the attitude of hope. And hope is a choice. And it's only by hoping that we can have any powerful impact on these problems at all. And that's what Pope Francis is telling us. It's what his witness boils down to for me. The profoundly hopeful attitude that this man brings to everything that he confronts, including some very difficult and intractable problems that define church life. But that's only a small part of the story, since it's the whole human species that is confronting such massive problems today.
Struck by you talking about these forces, and I don't mean to oversimplify this at all, but often the people who are using in Jesus' name are often those that deny that climate change even exists.
Sure. Jesus is yoked to people who don't believe in science. And it's the denial of science that's part of the problem at this point. A majority of Americans do not know that the overwhelming consensus of climate scientists is that climate change is real, catastrophic, and caused by human behavior. Science has been discredited in some large part by religious people who are at the mercy of the myth that science and religious faith are in conflict with each other. They aren't. Science is a glorious revelation of what religious faith is all about, the wonders of this creation that we live in. And taking science seriously, of course, means we have to be very serious about responding to climate change, learning from the scientists what exactly threatens and how to stop what threatens. Science is the latest wonder of the way God works in history. So those religious folks, many of them Christians, who are anti-science, need to be answered. They need to be argued with. These are crucial questions on which the future hangs. In my book, Christ Actually, I celebrate the arrival of the secular age because it makes very clear both the wonders of existence and what religion has to do to purify itself of those ways in which we have been a bane on existence instead of a celebration of it.
I was struck by a Boston Globe column that you wrote in opposition to President Obama's decision to re-enter the Middle East conflict and what we're doing with ISIS. And I don't disagree with you. I just ask the question as to, but what do we do? What is the answer in that regard, especially in light of seeing young men beheaded?
Yeah, it's true. It's grotesque. And the question, what do we do, is a hugely important one. What I would insist on first is that we don't do what will inevitably make it worse, what will empower ISIS, make them stronger, recruit many more people to their cause. And that is what happens when the United States military intervenes. Because we give so much power in our culture, in our economy, to the military, our alternative modes of response are weak. That's one of our biggest problems. We're so heavily invested in military solutions that our diplomatic and economic and soft power solutions get short shrift. So at a moment like this, when we're desperate to do something to stop these wicked people from kidnapping women and selling them into slavery and murdering innocent people right and left. Of course we have to find something to do about it, but by emphasizing our military responses, we make things worse, not better. So we have to get about the business of really shoring up diplomatic structures throughout the Middle East, for example. It's the nations of the Middle East, after all, that are most threatened by ISIS. So Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Israel itself, other Arab nations, they are the forefront of this struggle, and we have to find ways to support them in their response to ISIS. When the United States goes in with its bombs and drone missiles, you can bet that things are going to get worse, not better. And we also have to get serious about dismantling this huge structure of national security, which gives all too much weight to military power, and I'm afraid still to nuclear weapons, which is at the heart of our problem with Iran, also a player in this savage conflict in the Middle East. So the bottom line, we haven't ever dismantled the huge structure of military response we built to oppose the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union disappeared, but we didn't change our strategy in significant ways at all. And we have to get about doing that. Otherwise, we're going to be the source of catastrophe for the planet more than any other nation. That's what's really ahead of us, in my view.
James Carroll, thank you very much for being with us this morning. The name of the book is Christ, Actually the Son of God for the Secular Age. It is published by Viking. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.